Hello. I'm really sorry I've left my notes at home, so I'm a bit nervous. I just really wanted to share with you something amazing that happened to me a few weeks ago. For 10 years, I've had panic anxiety disorder. It's stopped me doing lots of things. It's given me panic attacks in the middle of things that shouldn't have given me panic attacks. There was no cause to it. It was just happened. I've been on and off of medication all of this time, and it was really starting to get me down. I didn't look forward to anything. I didn't get excited about anything. It was horrible. Then a couple of weeks ago at Arise, which is a group for women, I held at the Monroe's house, we went along and I wasn't really expecting anything to happen. Everybody said we were still praying and worshipping, and it was really, really lovely atmosphere, and I didn't feel anything. I was thinking, no, this isn't happening for me. Then it was that lots of people felt the Holy Spirit in the room and were getting some lovely imagery. I wasn't. I was getting horrible imagery. It was horrible. I thought, I'm not doing this anymore. And then the inevitable panic attack started coming in. So I left the room with Rachel, Joe and Teresa, who started to pray for me to be healed. And I had the biggest panic attack I have ever had. I was very vocal. It hurt. I was on the floor. I was shaking. It was horrendous. And it went. It just stopped. I felt it leave me. It was amazing. In my notes it says, don't cry. I can breathe deeply. I can be me again. And it feels so amazing. And at the very beginning, we were talking, Linda said that she'd seen like a racetrack and picking up people along the way. I felt like I was at the starting line. I've done my tick list. I've been baptized. I go to church every Sunday. I pray. I do these things, but I don't feel like I was ever moving forwards. And now I can. And I really want to encourage you this morning that God is in the long-term things. He's not just in the short-term things. This is 10 years it's taken to be healed from it. And I'm healed. And it feels amazing. And I can look forward to things. And I really want to encourage you this morning. Don't give up. God really does care about the long-term things as well. Just a plug for Arise, in case this isn't encouraging enough. It's going to be next Friday, 8 o'clock, sorry, 7:45 at John and Linda's house. We as women can be strong. Men are strong too, but we as women can be strong together. If you need some encouragement, if you want to talk about things as in a safe environment where just women are, please come along. It is a brilliant night. We are safe. It's worshipping. It's just amazing. So please come along next Friday.
Okay.
Hello. I don't know what to say now.
Hello. My name is Rob, and along with my wife, that's the notices at our other church. But you might have seen on your pews news on the back page that there is an invitation up to the farm on the 12th of July. Over the last 9 months, we've had the privilege of starting some work helping people who are struggling to find homes. And it is a stepping stone for them to move on in their life, not just to find homes, but to deal with some of the issues that they have, which is causing them to get to this place. So we've been working with a charity in Wales, based in Wales Elim Church, to help people out of homelessness. And we want to invite you to come and to have a look round, just to have a picnic, enjoy some sunshine, if it's not like today, on the farm, sit in the garden, have a picnic, meet some of the guys who have come through, who are there now, and maybe just have a look round, see if it's something that you'd be interested in, be involved with. But it's not pressured at all. It's not. We'd just rather that you came and saw.
We just feel really privileged that you're part of our church family as well. I have been for years, the Addicotts. And, you know, you guys have been up to the farm many times before, but this is just a new thing that we're doing up there, and we'd love you to see it. Even if you just wanted to pray for us, we just need prayer, and we just need support from our local family. There'll be cream teas and a tractor and trailer ride for the kids. So bring a picnic blanket, and it'll be in our back garden. So there's trampolines and croquet and all sorts of things. So it'll be fun. It'll be after church on the 12th. And it'll just give you a chance to visualise what we've been doing. And we've had various guys that have also settled in the Midsummer Norton area. So it'd be really nice to, and some of them have been to this church on various occasions, so it'd be really nice to just welcome you.
And there will be tractor trailer rides.
There's something which is very important and quite crucial that is going to start next week. It's the Tour de France, and it's quite an important event, and it's very much kind of exodus in a way, because you're trying to go around a country, going through the hardest routes, and you're trying to do that as quick as possible. And you go from one stage to the next, and I don't know if anyone's been looking really at how it works. There's some people who are interested in the sport, and you know, you've got the yellow jersey. But you also have a green one. You also have the king of the mountains. That's the red dots on a white background. They used to have a red jersey as well. And that means that there's different classifications. So you've got different things that you can race for. And some teams just decide, OK, on that stage, on that day, we've got a chance, so we're going to just work on that one. There's a handful of people that have a chance of winning the overall thing, the yellow jersey. But that means in that event, there's bits for everyone to win, even if the big title is really for just a handful of people that can actually do that. And I can see some similarities with the Exodus. Apart from, the major thing is that it's not a race. The Exodus is not a race. And we'll come back to that in a minute. We're going to read in a second chapter 18 of the Exodus. I'm going to give you a bit of time to just find the correct page. In the Exodus chapter 18. And before we do that, because I'm talking to a British audience, I need to clarify one thing. The Jethro in the story is not a rude comedian. He's got nothing to do with rock music, because there's another Jethro thing. That's, okay. It is somebody who is simply the father-in-law of Moses, the big prophet. Okay. Thank you.
Now Jethro, the priest of Midian and father-in-law of Moses, heard of everything God had done for Moses and for his people Israel, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. After Moses had sent away his wife Zipporah, his father-in-law Jethro received her and her two sons. One son was named Gershom, for Moses said, "I have become a foreigner in a foreign land." And the other was named Eleazar, for he said, "My father's God was my helper. He saved me from the sword of Pharaoh." Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, together with Moses' sons and wife, came to him in the wilderness, where he was camped near the mountain of God. Jethro had sent word to him, "I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons." So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him. They greeted each other and then went into the tent. Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and about all the hardships that they had met along the way, and how the Lord had saved them. Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hand of the Egyptians. He said, "Praise be to the Lord who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh, and who rescued the people from the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods, for he did this to those who had treated Israel arrogantly." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God. The next day Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you're doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, while all these people stand around you from morning till evening?" Moses answered him, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will, whenever they have a dispute, it's brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and instructions." Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you're doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I'll give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them his decrees and instructions, and show them the way they are to live and how they are to behave. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter, because they will share it with you. If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied. Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. He chose capable men from all Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. They served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided themselves. Then Moses sent his father-in-law on his way, and Jethro returned to his own country.
Lord, open our hearts and help us to really understand your word, and not to be just hearers, but people who put things in practice. Amen. Okay. It's a long chapter, you agree with me. And chapters are quite new. Chapters are not part of our original Bible. The chapters have been introduced when printing started, because it was easier to print in chapters. So they are actually quite new. And I believe that what we call that chapter, we call that chapter 18, is actually very much part of the same story as the one that we looked at last week. And Dave just got quite a few interesting points out of that. And we are going today to see the complete story. So I will be referring back to what Dave said and what we read in chapter 17. So go back through later in your own time, just read through, and hopefully you will see the connections. Now, I need to say something about the language of the Bible, how that language actually works, because it's an old book, the Exodus. We're talking about something that was written at least 3,000 years ago, if you're talking about the last few bits that were written in terms of punctuation, really. And it's important for us to measure the distance between what used to be the case and our lives today. And if we were given a Bible, it is not simply to know what used to happen to these people in that desert. It is because it means much more. And it is a story of humanity. It is the story of how humans behave when they are in these sort of situations. Okay. What makes it so special, the Exodus, as a story, as a book? It's mainly a lot of parallels with the New Testament. The parallels of the New Testament, if I'm just saying that, you will ask me, okay, why you on about? Give me an example. So the first example is, and now starts the quiz. Okay? So here's the answer. No hands up, you can just give me the answer. Who is killing innocents at the beginning of the Gospels? Who is killing innocents at the beginning of the Gospel? Herod. Who is killing innocents at the beginning of Exodus? Pharaoh. And the Gospels put Herod on a par with Pharaoh. This is the type of bloodthirsty tyrant, and these are the sort of people we need to be liberated from. Who's teaching? Second question in the quiz. Who is teaching a lot of people, who is teaching to a large crowd from the top of a mountain in the Bible? Who is teaching a large crowd from the top of a mountain? Some people say Jesus, some people say Moses, and you're absolutely right. Both answers are absolutely correct. When in the New Testament Jesus teaches what we call the Sermon on the Mount, the Gospels are putting Jesus on a par in the same category as the great prophet Moses, the one who gave the law to the people of Israel. So the book of Exodus works very much as a sort of template, more than announcing, certainly announcing the New Testament, but also giving it shape. Okay. We have a lot of stages built into the book of Exodus. We are going to look at this stage, this point in time, when Jethro comes to visit his family. I'm going to start with sacrifices. That's my first point. And now, you might be afraid to have a very dull subject. Sacrifices. Okay, it is dull because to us, the whole idea of a sacrifice is actually very foreign. We don't do that, do we? The Romans, in any family, Romans would do a sacrifice first thing in the morning. They would all, in a Roman house, you would have a little altar and you would sacrifice to the spirits of your family. That would be the first thing that the paterfamilias, the head of the family, has to do in the morning. Get the family together, 3-4 minutes, you get them together, and you do an offering on that altar. And that means you just put a few fruit on that sort of shelf, really. You put a few fruits on the shelf, a few things to eat. You leave it all day, and when you come back home in the evening, you eat it. But in the meantime, it had been offered to the spirits of your ancestors. Okay, that's the Romans. We are not talking about Romans, we are talking about people in the Bible. Okay, my first point on that. Even if there's no need to get into all the details of sacrifices, the key point is that this sacrifice, and we're going to read it again together, just one verse, verse 12, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God. This is the first sacrifice that the people of Israel, the people of God, are offering to God after leaving Egypt. And if you remember, the first request of Moses to Pharaoh was, can we please go out in the desert for 3 days and sacrifice to our God? That was Moses' first request to Pharaoh. Pharaoh refused that one, and it went very bad for him after that. But here we have that very first sacrifice. And the first one, the initial one, the original one, means something. Now, sacrifice is not something you just give away. It's not something that you take from your possessions and get rid of, offer it, give it away for very good cause, a very good reason. It's not just that. A sacrifice is something that you actually share. A sacrifice is a festive meal. Now here we have the mention of two different types of sacrifices. If you read with me, the same verse, a burnt offering and I would rather say, and the other sacrifices, rather than just other sacrifices, but I'm being picky on it. Olam veteram. These are the words in Hebrew, in the Bible, and that implies two different things that they actually did. Yes, the burnt offering is the one that is completely given away. You lose that. That means you get a bit of meat and you consume it completely on the altar, which is just another word for a big barbecue. However, there is another type of sacrifice, or other types of sacrifices. Most sacrifices are about cooking the meat and eating it and turning it into a real festive meal. And that's what they're doing. With all the elders of Israel, they eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God. It's as if the togetherness of these people is linked to the presence of God. What is important is that sacrifices are not about just one mood. We would probably think that a sacrifice is something that has to be sad. Okay, it can be. It starts like that, maybe, with remorse. It starts with regrets. It starts with an inside conversion. Yes, it may start there, but it doesn't finish there. The important bit is that it journeys. A sacrifice is also a type of journey that ends up in a festive meal. It ends and it leads to joy. Now, I know that when we celebrate communion, we not always express this change of mood, this journey into emotions. But this is the idea behind it. It finishes with a celebration of Jesus' resurrection. I think we should do the communion with champagne. It's the idea. It's a celebration. It's about being together and knowing where we've got to. Final point maybe on that. It is a shared meal. It's the first sacrifice for the people of Israel. And it is offered not by a Hebrew, but it is offered by Jethro. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering. The first sacrifice for Israel is not an Israelite sacrifice, but it comes from the priest of Midian. We don't know anything about Midian as a priesthood. What is that sort of priest? Okay, we have a little bit of a mystery there, which is quite interesting. But the important bit is that he was not an Israelite. It was offered, the first sacrifice for Israel was offered by a foreigner. I like foreigners. Now, these two chapters form one big story. We've got different episodes in the same story. From chapter 18, from 17, sorry, the chapter that we looked at last week, we might get the impression that foreign influence is bad. The war against the Amalekite ends up with us reading it as if foreign influence was completely and always bad. The next chapter is describing Jethro, another foreigner, with very good influence. So Amalek is this figure of evil, and Jethro is this figure of the good advice that is coming from the outside. Something that links up these two chapters in just one story is the posture of Moses. Against the Amalekite, Moses had to sit down because the deal was that if he kept his arms up, Israel was prevailing. When his arms were going down, Amalek was prevailing. He needed a bit of help, so he sat down. And Joshua and Hur came to the rescue and held his arms up so that they could win the battle. The authority of Moses is symbolized by the fact that he's sitting down. In this chapter, the authority of Moses, his authority to be the judge over God's people, is symbolized by the fact that he takes his seat. Sits down and then starts judging. His sitting position is the sign of his authority. That's not something new. Who's been to a cathedral? What's a cathedral? A cathedral is a place where you have a cathedral. What is the cathedral? It is the seat of the bishop. Not very comfy, it's normally quite hardwood, but that is the symbol of his see, and a see is another word for sitting. So we have kept somehow in our culture, in our English culture, an idea of, you know, sitting as authority. We tend to call it a throne. It's properly called a cathedra. I'd like to say something about Moses' wives. His first wife, Tzipora, she's got a very nice name. Tzipor is the bird. Tzipora is the little bird. Birdlet, if you want, as a good name for a wife, I guess. Yeah. She is from Midian. So Moses, the big prophet of Israel, has a wife who is not an Israelite. He later got a second wife. We don't know if Zipporah died or okay. But he had another wife, and she was from Cush. And Cush is somewhere between Somalia, Eritrea, Ethiopia, or Sudan. What we know from that is that Moses' second wife was a black African. Moses, prophet of Israel, had two wives. None of them were Israelites. Now, foreign influence cannot be completely bad. Amalek may be the symbol of bad foreign influence, but Midian is the sign of good foreign influence. Jethro shows Moses and the elders of the Hebrews, shows them how you do a sacrifice. What is very interesting is that it is happening just one or two chapters before the Ten Commandments are given. Just a few chapters before all the laws regarding the sacrifices are given. And basically, Jethro, in God's wisdom, Jethro is showing them, okay, this is what you're going to be taught about by God himself. This is what sacrifice looks like. Do it properly. Now, it's good to be showed what the ropes are by someone who knows. Third point. Doing too much. And that is the core of Jethro's advice. Three verses that I'm going to look at now. From verses 17 to 19. Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you're doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen. Listen now. Listen now to me. And I will give you some advice. And may God be with you." Right. Moses is clearly the prophet raised by God. He is the one who is called to be the big prophet. And yet, Jethro feels the need to tell him, "What you're doing is not good. That's no good, mate." It's not a question of being the father-in-law. I think it's a question of looking at the way things were operating and so just, that doesn't make sense. Come on. And Jethro's advice is common sense. Let's hear it again. "You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them his decrees and instructions and show them the way they are to live and how they are to behave." That is Jethro speaking. "But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you." That's the appeal procedure. "The simple cases, they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter because they will share it with you." We would simply call that delegating. Yes? We need to delegate. I have a boss who's not very good at delegating. But delegating is something that we all know is necessary, and we need to do that. Okay, it's reasonable. It's common sense. One man, even the chosen prophet, cannot cope with such a workload. We don't have to control everything, but we can trust others to do as good a job as we can. And that's where it's not that easy. We don't have to control everything. We will most agree with that. Where it becomes quite difficult to delegate is trusting others to do as good as we can. Now, Israel already had elders and leaders. When they were in Egypt, they had elders and leaders. There's nothing new there. The only thing is that they need to be a different type of elders. It's a different organization, parallel for giving justice, judging simply. That means that Jethro's suggestion is about keeping separate the ordinary political authority of the leaders from the organization of justice. Okay. Do you like politics? Because the Exodus is very political, in the best sense of the word political. What we read there is something that us modern may well call the separation of powers. It is about creating a kind of modern state. That's the advice Jethro is giving. Beside the political order, the political leaders, you need to have separate men who are judges and who will make sure that justice is real among the people. The Exodus is a journey of organization. It's about how the people of God can, should get organized. Now, if we take Amalek, and if we take Jethro, the priest of Midian, they are like brackets, helping us to understand what discernment is. We need to discern inferences. It's not necessarily the source of the inference that is a problem. It's what this inference leads to. In today's story, Jethro is having a huge influence. Jethro shows to the leaders of Israel what sacrifices look like, and it shows Moses how to make justice a well-oiled machine, something that works. And that's where capable men are very important. That's a surprising point. Those who will judge alongside Moses do not need to be well-born. To be a priest, you need to be the son of a priest. To be a judge, there is no mention of having to be the son of a judge. That's very different. There isn't an aristocracy. Ezekiel was a priest in Israel. Ezekiel was in exile. Ezekiel was a priest that was supposed to be serving God in a temple that no longer existed. For Ezekiel, the big question is, what am I supposed to be doing? What I am is a priest to the God I know. He is the great God, and I don't have a temple to do that. Who am I? What is left of me? There is no question of lineage about justice, but capable men, trustworthy and God-fearing. It really is about discernment. It's not about blindingly dismissing influence on the simple ground that it's outside. It's coming from the outside. And Paul himself says it very, very clearly when he's addressing the question of eating meals offered in the name of Zeus or Apollo or Hera. What Paul says is that as a Christian, you know that such idols do not exist. There isn't a Zeus, there isn't Apollo, so it's okay. Just enjoy the meal and join in. Get with the people who are out there rejoicing. Be part of that. Read all that, in 1 Corinthians 8, 9, 10. But Paul adds, you need to take care not to offend those inside the church, because it looks a bit strange that you are participating to a meal offered in the name of idols that do not exist. For Moses, to share the load, he had to learn how to trust others. He was the prophet, and that is the reason why he didn't come to the obvious conclusion that he had to share the load. Moses tried to get out of trouble by telling God, okay, not me, please. I can't do that. I'm not capable. I'm rubbish at all these things. I'm no good at speaking in public. Moses tried to use all of those good reasons to get God to choose another one to be his prophet. But Moses knew one thing, is that he was responsible for his calling. Ultimately, it was his job to judge Israel. And it's being between that dilemma. The dilemma for Moses is, okay, it's my responsibility to make sure that the judging happens correctly. It's heavy workload, but it still is my job. If you cannot trust others to do as good a job as you, there is no way you're going to delegate that. And it is a question of discernment. Okay, let me take an example to clarify that. My children are my responsibility. Okay, so it's my responsibility to teach them about God. It's my responsibility to show them a sort of half-decent Christian living style. It is my responsibility. I have to do that. I have to make sure at every moment that they are safe. And sometimes it means running after them. A lot. I remember one day, and I have, it was very hot Sunday morning. And all the side doors were open. So that one, that one, that one, and that one. Okay? Which means that when I came into church, I felt like going home because that wasn't safe, mainly for one of my my children. Okay? So I posted myself just by this door, just to make sure that I could just catch the child that was likely to sort of. And Dave noticed that I was just standing there, and just took him a bit of time to sort of understand what it was all about, and then sort of, oh yeah. So he went to post himself just by this door, and that was great because we were covered, both sides. The only thing is that there was a little girl, I can't remember which child it was, but a little girl that just fell, and obviously Dave just went down to help that little child, grabbed the child, and while he had the child in the hand, Matthew just nodded his hand, just legged it. Okay. But ultimately, it's my responsibility to make sure that all my children are safe, but I still need to trust others at one point. It's my responsibility to teach them to be children of God. Show them the ropes, just like Jethro showed Moses what it looks like. It's okay, I've got no child there. Just a request. But it is also my responsibility to trust, to show my trust in all the energy group leaders, the Sunday school teachers. I need to trust them. It still is my responsibility to do the ultimate thing, but we need to trust others to do things. And that's where the people of God, the church, is very important. Okay. We do not need to be afraid of the world. If we know that there are some Amalekites out there. But we still do not need to be afraid of the world. We need to bear in mind that there are Midianites too. And they can be the good influence from the outside. Okay. We're going to conclude our series on the Exodus, and you understand that it's about journeying and it's about moving on, okay, and maybe it's time for us to move on. To do that, I would like you to use your imagination. If you feel like it, close your eyes, and I want you to imagine a spiritual map. On this spiritual map, on the bottom corner on the left, imagine the River Nile. On this spiritual map that you can imagine, on the top right corner, imagine the land of milk and honey. There is the Eiffel Tower on it. And I want you, much more seriously, and I want you to try to put yourself on that map. I've got six stations, six stages. There is obviously much more. This is not the whole list. But try to put yourself on this spiritual map. A. Are you still in Egypt? Do you feel that you are in the land of bondage? You feel that you are slave in some kind of way to certain things or certain people. You are not free yet. Not free yet. And you need to get your liberation. God wants you to be free. And today is as good a day as there will ever be. Do you feel a slave in a spiritual Egypt? Do you feel there is no rest, no Sabbath, and the hassle is relentless? You can claim your freedom now. Stage B. Another stage could be just by the water of the sea. You need to cross the sea to escape from Pharaoh's army. You need to cross the water. You need to have the boldness to be baptized. Is it your stage by the seashore, hesitant? I pray that you are convinced by the Holy Spirit to cross the water of baptism. Stage C. Another stage on our spiritual map could be this. You need to whack the dry rocks and see fresh water spring out of it. You have a spiritual thirst, and you haven't found yet the fresh water you need. Share the load. Ask people around you when we will having coffee soon. You can have that time when you can ask people to help you. You need to grab a stick, a spiritual stick, and hit the rock, a spiritual rock, so water will refresh you. But do something to get the water you need. Thirst is good. It makes you look for a drink. But if you do not find a drink, thirst might kill you. Stage D. Another stage on our spiritual map could be this. You need to see the desert through. You are getting drier and drier. You feel you have been wandering for too long in that arid desert. Someone will point an oasis to you. Ask people around you when we have a coffee again. Someone may even point to the end of the desert. Someone may even take you to the land of milk and honey. Stage E. Another stage on our spiritual map could be this. It is time to make a big decision. Do you need to consider taking a big step? Do you think you could be fostering, as we mentioned last week? Do you think you have to leap in faith and make a big decision? Stage F. Another stage on our spiritual map could be this. You simply need to get to the next stage. You have been involved in the same church ministry for a while and you feel it is time for something else. You need to move on, not to something big, but move on nonetheless. If this spiritual map is speaking to you, if you need your Exodus to follow its course and it all needs to get moving, I will suggest two different paths. Grab someone, grab some elders. I think I'm the only one here this morning, so yeah, could be me. Grab someone, house group leader, someone you trust. It's not a question of title or whatever. No, grab someone you trust. You can only share the load with someone you trust. Grab someone who was somewhere. Have a chat and pray together. This morning we can find you can find a space for that. When we all are having teas and coffees, ask one another. If you could put yourself on this imaginary spiritual map I described, and you don't have to give details, but maybe it's something that you could share about. Bottom line is that you need to get a move on. We are going to have a couple of minutes with this time of reflection, with music in the background. And I want you to think, where are you on your spiritual map? Then we will have some worship songs. May God bless you. May God bless your meditation. And may God bless your next steps. Thank you.